Mind, and don't let her slip. That's as may happen, answered Rostov. Karai, here, he shouted, answering Uncle's remark by this call to his borzoi. Karai was a shaggy old dog with a hanging jowl, famous for having tackled a big wolf unaided. They all took up their places. The old count, knowing his son's ardour in the hunt, hurried so as not to be late, and the huntsmen had not yet reached their places when Count Ilya Rostov, cheerful, flushed, and with quivering cheeks, drove up with his black horses over the winter rye to the place reserved for him, where a wolf might come out. Having straightened his coat and fastened on his hunting knives and horn, he mounted his good, sleek, well-fed and comfortable horse, Fiflyanka, which was turning grey like himself. His horses and trap were sent home. Count Ilya Rostov, though not at heart a keen sportsman, knew the rules of the hunt well, and rode to the bushy edge of the road where he was to stand, arranged his reins, settled himself in the saddle, and, feeling that he was ready, looked about with a smile. Beside him was Semyon Chekmar, his personal attendant, an old horseman now somewhat stiff in the saddle. Chekmar held in leash three formidable wolfhounds, who had, however, grown fat like their master and his horse. Two wise old dogs lay down unleashed. Some 100 paces farther along the edge of the wood stood Mitka, the count's other groom, a daring horseman and keen rider to hounds. Before the hunt, by old custom, the count had drunk a silver cupful of mulled brandy, taken a snack, and washed it down with half a bottle of his favourite Bordeaux. He was somewhat flushed with the wine and the drive. His eyes were rather moist and glittered more than usual, and as he sat in his saddle, wrapped up in his fur coat, he looked like a child taken out for an outing. The thin, hollow-cheeked Chekmar, having got everything ready, kept glancing at his master, with whom he had lived on the best of terms for 30 years, and understanding the mood he was in, expected a pleasant chat. A third person rode up circumspectly through the wood. It was plain that he had had a lesson, and stopped behind the count. This person was a grey-bearded old man in a woman's cloak, with a tall, peaked cap on his head. He was the buffoon, who went by a woman's name, Nastasia Ivanovna. "Well, Nastasia Ivanovna," whispered the count, winking at him, "if you scare away the beast, Daniel'll give it to you." "I know a thing or two myself," said Nastasia Ivanovna. "Hush!" whispered the count, and turned to Semyon. "Have you seen the young countess?" he asked. "Where is she?" "With young Count Pyotr, by the Zahara of rank grass," answered Semyon, smiling. "Though she's a lady, she's very fond of hunting." "And you're surprised at the way she rides, Semyon, eh?" said the count. "She's as good as many a man." "Of course, she's marvellous, so bold, so easy. And Nikolai, where is he? By the Lyadov upland, isn't he?"
"Yes, sir. He knows where to stand. He understands the matter so well that Daniel and I are often quite astounded," said Semyon, well knowing what would please his master.
"Rides well, eh? And how well he looks on his horse, eh? A perfect picture. How he chased a fox out of the rank grass by the Zavarzink's thicket the other day. Leapt in a fearful place. What a sight when they rushed from the covert. The horse worth 1,000 rubles and the rider beyond all price. Yes, one would have to search far to find another as smart."
"To search far," repeated the count, evidently sorry Semyon had not said more.
"To search far," he said, turning back the skirt of his coat to get at his snuff-box.
"The other day, when he came out from Mass in full uniform, Mikhail Sidorich—" Semyon did not finish, for on the still air he had distinctly caught the music of the hunt, with only 2 or 3 hounds giving tongue. He bent down his head and listened, shaking a warning finger at his master. "They are on the scent of the cubs," he whispered, "straight to the Lyadov uplands."
The count, forgetting to smooth out the smile on his face, looked into the distance straight before him, down the narrow, open space, holding the snuff-box in his hand, but not taking any. After the cry of the hounds came the deep tones of the wolf-call from Daniel's hunting-horn. The pack joined the first 3 hounds, and they could be heard in full cry, with that peculiar lift in the note that indicates that they're after a wolf.
The whippers-in no longer set on the hounds, but changed to the cry of "Ooh-yoo-yoo-yoo!" And above the others rose Daniel's voice, now a deep bass, now piercingly shrill. His voice seemed to fill the whole wood and carried far beyond out into the open field. After listening a few moments in silence, the Count and his attendant convinced themselves that the hounds had separated into two packs. The sound of the larger pack, eagerly giving tongue, began to die away in the distance. The other pack rushed by the wood past the Count, and it was with this that Daniel's voice was heard calling, "Ooh-yoo-yoo-yoo!" The sounds of both packs mingled and broke apart again, but both were becoming more distant. Semyon sighed and stooped to straighten the leash a young bourgeois had entangled. The Count sighed too, and noticing the snuff-box in his hand, opened it and took a pinch. "Back!" cried Semyon to a bourgeois that was pushing forward out of the wood. The Count started and dropped the snuff-box. Nastasia Ivanovna dismounted to pick it up. The Count and Semyon were looking at him. Then, unexpectedly, as often happens, the sound of the hunt suddenly approached, as if the hounds in full cry and Daniel ooh-yoo-yoo-yooing were just in front of them. The Count turned and saw on his right Mitka staring at him with eyes starting out of his head, raising his cap and pointing before him to the other side. "Look out!" he shouted, in a voice plainly showing that he had long fretted to utter that word, and letting the bourgeois slip, he galloped towards the Count. The Count and Semyon galloped out of the wood and saw on their left a wolf, which, softly swaying from side to side, was coming at a quiet lope farther to the left to the very place where they were standing. The angry bourgeois whined, and getting free of the leash, rushed past the horse's feet at the wolf. The wolf paused, turned its heavy forehead towards the dogs awkwardly, like a man suffering from the quinsy, and still slightly swaying from side to side, gave a couple of leaps and, with a swish of its tail, disappeared into the skirt of the wood. At the same instant, with a cry like a wail, first one hound, then another, and then another, sprang helter-skelter from the wood opposite, and the whole pack rushed across the field toward the very spot where the wolf had disappeared. The hazel bushes parted behind the hounds, and Daniel's chestnut horse appeared, dark with sweat. On its long back sat Daniel, hunched forward, capless, his dishevelled grey hair hanging over his flushed, perspiring face. "Ooh-yoo-yoo-yoo-yoo-yoo!" he cried. When he caught sight of the Count, his eyes flashed lightning. "Blast you!" he shouted, holding up his whip threateningly at the Count. "You've let the wolf go! What sportsmen!" And as if scorning to say more to the frightened and shamefaced Count, he lashed the heaving flanks of his sweating chestnut gelding with all the anger the Count had aroused and flew off after the hounds. The Count, like a punished schoolboy, looked round, trying by a smile to win Semyon's sympathy for his plight. But Semyon was no longer there. He was galloping round by the bushes while the field was coming up on both sides, all trying to head off the wolf. But it vanished into the wood before they could do so. Chapter 5. Nikolai Rostov, meanwhile, remained at his post, waiting for the wolf. By the way the hunt approached and receded, by the cries of the dogs whose notes were familiar to him, by the way the voices of the huntsmen approached, receded, and rose, he realized what was happening at the copse. He knew that young and old wolves were there, that the hounds had separated into two packs, that somewhere a wolf was being chased, and that something had gone wrong. He expected the wolf to come his way any moment. He made thousands of different conjectures as to where and from what side the beast would come and how he would set upon it. Hope alternated with despair. Several times he addressed a prayer to God that the wolf should come his way. He prayed with that passionate and shame-faced feeling with which men pray at moments of great excitement arising from trivial causes. "What would it be to thee to do this for me?" he said to God. "I know thou art great, and that it is a sin to ask this of thee, but for God's sake, do let the old wolf come my way, and let Karai spring at it, in sight of Uncle, who's watching from over there, and seize it by the throat in a death grip." 1,000 times during that half hour, Rostov cast eager and restless glances over the edge of the wood, with the two scraggy oaks rising above the aspen undergrowth and the gully with its water-worn side and Uncle's cap just visible above the bush on his right. No, I shan't have such luck, thought Rostov. Yet what wouldn't it be worth? It is not to be. Everywhere, at cards and in war, I'm always unlucky. Memories of Austerlitz and of Dolokhov flashed rapidly and clearly through his mind. Only once in my life to get an old wolf. I want only that, thought he, straining eyes and ears and looking to the left and then to the right and listening to the slightest variation of note in the cries of the dogs. Again he looked to the right and saw something running toward him across the deserted field. No, it can't be, thought Rostov, taking a deep breath, as a man does at the coming of something long hoped for. The height of happiness was reached, and so simply, without warning or noise or display, that Rostov could not believe his eyes, and remained in doubt for over a second. The wolf ran forward and jumped heavily over a gully that lay in her path. She was an old animal with a grey back and big reddish belly. She ran without hurry, evidently feeling sure that no one saw her. Rostov, holding his breath, looked round at the borzois. They stood or lay, not seeing the wolf or understanding the situation. Old Karai had turned his head and was angrily searching for fleas, baring his yellow teeth and snapping at his hind legs.
"Ulu-lu-lu-lu-lu-lu,"
whispered Rostov, pouting his lips. The borzois jumped up, jerking the rings of the leashes and pricking up their ears. Karai finished scratching his hind quarters and, cocking his ears, got up with quivering tail, from which tufts of matted hair hung down. "Shall I loose them or not?" Nikolai asked himself as the wolf approached him coming from the copse. Suddenly the wolf's whole physiognomy changed. She shuddered, seeing what she had probably never seen before, human eyes fixed upon her, and turning her head a little toward Rostov, she paused. "Backward or forward? Hey, no matter, forward," the wolf seemed to say to herself, and she moved forward without again looking round, and with a quiet, long, easy, yet resolute lope.
"Ulu-lu-lu-lu!"
cried Nikolai in a voice not his own, and of its own accord his good horse darted headlong downhill, leaping over gullies to head off the wolf, and the borzois passed it, running faster still. Nikolai did not hear his own cry, nor feel that he was galloping, nor see the borzois, nor the ground over which he went. He saw only the wolf, who, increasing her speed, bounded on in the same direction along the hollow. The first to come into view was Milka, with her black markings and powerful quarters gaining upon the wolf. Nearer and nearer, now she was ahead of it, but the wolf turned its head to face her, and instead of putting on speed as she usually did, Milka suddenly raised her tail and stiffened her forelegs.
"Ulu-lu-lu-lu!"
shouted Nikolai. The reddish Lyubim rushed forward from behind Milka, sprang impetuously at the wolf and seized it by its hind quarters, but immediately jumped aside in terror. The wolf crouched, gnashed her teeth and again rose and bounded forward, followed at the distance of a couple of feet by all the borzois, who did not get any closer to her.
"She'll get away! No, it's impossible!" thought Nikolai, still shouting with a hoarse voice. "Karai! Ulu-lu-lu-lu-lu!"
he shouted, looking round for the old borzoi who was now his only hope. Karai, with all the strength age had left him, stretched himself to the utmost, and watching the wolf, galloped heavily aside to intercept it. But the quickness of the wolf's lope and the borzoi's slower pace made it plain that Karai had miscalculated. Nikolai could already see, not far in front of him, the wood where the wolf would certainly escape should she reach it. But coming toward him, he saw hounds and a huntsman galloping almost straight at the wolf. There was still hope. A long, yellowish young borzoi, one Nikolai did not know from another leash, rushed impetuously at the wolf from in front and almost knocked her over. But the wolf jumped up more quickly than anyone could have expected, and gnashing her teeth flew at the yellow borzoi, which, with a piercing yelp, fell with its head on the ground, bleeding from a gash in its side.
"Karai, old fellow!" wailed Nikolai.
Thanks to the delay caused by this crossing of the wolf's path, the old dog with its felted hair hanging from its thigh was within 5 paces of it. As if aware of her danger, the wolf turned her eyes on Karai, tucked her tail yet further between her legs, and increased her speed. But here Nikolai only saw that something happened to Karai. The Borzoi was suddenly on the wolf, and they rolled together down into a gully just in front of them. That instant, when Nikolai saw the wolf struggling in the gully with the dogs, while from under them could be seen her grey hair and outstretched hind leg, and her frightened, choking head with her ears laid back, Karai was pinning her by the throat, was the happiest moment of his life. With his hand on his saddle bow, he was ready to dismount and stab the wolf, when she suddenly thrust her head up from among that mass of dogs, and then her forepaws were on the edge of the gully. She clicked her teeth. Karai no longer had her by the throat, leapt with a movement of her hind legs out of the gully, and having disengaged herself from the dogs, with tail tucked in again, went forward. Karai, his hair bristling and probably bruised or wounded, climbed with difficulty out of the gully. "Oh, my God, why?" Nikolai cried in despair. Uncle's huntsman was galloping from the other side across the wolf's path, and his borzois once more stopped the animal's advance. She was again hemmed in. Nikolai and his attendant, with Uncle and his huntsman, were all riding round the wolf, crying, "Ulululululu!" shouting and preparing to dismount each moment that the wolf crouched back, and starting forward every time she shook herself and moved toward the wood, where she would be safe. Already at the beginning of this chase, Daniel, hearing the ululululuing, had rushed out from the wood. He saw Karai seize the wolf and checked his horse, supposing the affair to be over. But when he saw that the horsemen did not dismount, and that the wolf shook herself and ran for safety, Daniel set his chestnut galloping, not at the wolf, but straight toward the wood, just as Karai had run to cut the animal off. As a result of this, he galloped up to the wolf just when she had been stopped a second time by Uncle's borzois. Daniel galloped up silently, holding a naked dagger in his left hand and thrashing the labouring sides of his chestnut horse with a whip as if it were a flail. Nikolai neither saw nor heard Daniel until the chestnut, breathing heavily, panted past him, and he heard the fall of a body and saw Daniel lying on the wolf's back among the dogs, trying to seize her by the ears. It was evident to the dogs, the hunters, and to the wolf herself that all was now over. The terrified wolf pressed back her ears and tried to rise, but the borzois stuck to her. Daniel rose a little, took a step, and with his whole weight, as if lying down to rest, fell on the wolf, seizing her by the ears. Nikolai was about to stab her, but Daniel whispered, "Don't, we'll gag her," and changing his position, set his foot on the wolf's neck. A stick was thrust between her jaws, and she was fastened with a leash as if bridled. Her legs were bound together, and Daniel rolled her over once or twice from side to side. With happy, exhausted faces, they laid the old wolf alive on a shying and snorting horse, and, accompanied by the dogs yelping at her, took her to the place where they were all to meet. The hounds had killed two of the cubs, and the borzois three. The huntsmen assembled with their booty and their stories, and all came to look at the wolf, which, with her broad-browed head hanging down and bitten stick between her jaws, gazed with great glassy eyes at this crowd of dogs and men surrounding her. When she was touched, she jerked her bound legs and looked wildly, yet simply, at everybody. Old Count Rostov also rode up and touched the wolf.
"Oh, what a formidable one," said he. "A formidable one, eh?"
he asked Daniel, who was standing near.
"Yes, Your Excellency," answered Daniel, quickly doffing his cap.
The Count remembered the wolf he had let slip and his encounter with Daniel.
"Ah, but you're a crusty fellow, friend," said the Count.
For sole reply, Daniel gave him a shy, childlike, meek, and amiable smile. Chapter 6 The Fox Hunt. The old Count went home, and Natasha and Petya promised to return very soon, but as it was still early, the hunt went farther. At midday they put the hounds into a ravine thickly overgrown with young trees. Nikolai, standing in a fallow field, could see all his whips. Facing him lay a field of winter rye. There his own huntsman stood alone in a hollow behind a hazel bush. The hounds had scarcely been loosed before Nikolai heard one he knew, Voltorn, giving tongue at intervals. Other hounds joined in, now pausing and now again giving tongue,
A moment later he heard a cry from the wooded ravine that a fox had been found, and the whole pack, joining together, rushed along the ravine toward the rye field and away from Nikolai. He saw the whips in their red caps galloping along the edge of the ravine. He even saw the hounds and was expecting a fox to show itself at any moment on the rye field opposite. The huntsman, standing in the hollow, moved and loosed his borzois, and Nikolai saw a queer, short-legged red fox with a fine brush going hard across the field. The borzois bore down on it. Now they drew close to the fox, which began to dodge between the field in sharper and sharper curves, trailing its brush. When suddenly a strange white borzois dashed in, followed by a black one, and everything was in confusion. The borzois formed a star-shaped figure, scarcely swaying their bodies and with tails turned away from the centre of the group. Two huntsmen galloped up to the dogs, one in a red cap, the other a stranger in a green coat. "What's this?" thought Nikolai. "Where's that huntsman from? He's not Uncle's man." The huntsmen got the fox, but stayed there a long time without strapping it to the saddle. Their horses, bridled with high saddles, stood near them, and there too the dogs were lying. The huntsmen waved their arms and did something to the fox. Then, from that spot came the sound of a horn, with the signal agreed on in case of a fight. "That's Ilyagin's huntsman, having a row with our Ivan," said Nikolai's groom. Nikolai sent the man to call Natasha and Petya to him, and rode at a footpace to the place where the whips were getting the hounds together. Several of the field galloped to the spot where the fight was going on. Nikolai dismounted, and with Natasha and Petya, who had ridden up, stopped near the hounds, waiting to see how the matter would end. Out of the bushes came the huntsman who had been fighting and rode toward his young master, with the fox tied to his crupper. While still at a distance, he took off his cap and tried to speak respectfully, but he was pale and breathless, and his face was angry. One of his eyes was black, but he probably was not even aware of it. "What has happened?" asked Nikolai. "A likely thing. Killing a fox our dogs had hunted, and it was my grey bitch that caught it. Go to law, indeed. He snatches at the fox. I gave him one with the fox. Here it is on my saddle. Do you want a taste of this?" said the huntsman, pointing to his dagger and probably imagining himself still speaking to his foe. Nikolai, not stopping to talk to the man, asked his sister and Petya to wait for him and rode to the spot where the enemy's, Ilyagin's, hunting party was. The victorious huntsman rode off to join the field, and there, surrounded by inquiring sympathizers, recounted his exploits. The facts were that Ilyagin, with whom the Rostovs had a quarrel and were at law, hunted over places that belonged by custom to the Rostovs, and had now, as if purposely, sent his men to the very woods the Rostovs were hunting, and let his man snatch a fox their dogs had chased. Nikolai, though he had never seen Ilyagin, with his usual absence of moderation in judgment, hated him cordially from reports of his arbitrariness and violence, and regarded him as his bitterest foe. He rode in angry agitation toward him, firmly grasping his whip and fully prepared to take the most resolute and desperate steps to punish his enemy. Hardly had he passed an angle of the wood before a stout gentleman in a beaver cap came riding toward him on a handsome raven-black horse, accompanied by two hunt servants. Instead of an enemy, Nikolai found in Ilyagin a stately and courteous gentleman who was particularly anxious to make the young count's acquaintance. Having ridden up to Nikolai, Ilyagin raised his beaver cap and said he much regretted what had occurred and would have the man punished who had allowed himself to seize a fox hunted by someone else's borzois. He hoped to become better acquainted with the count and invited him to draw his covert. Natasha, afraid that her brother would do something dreadful, had followed him in some excitement. Seeing the enemies exchanging friendly greetings, she rode up to them. Ilyagin lifted his beaver cap still higher to Natasha and said, with a pleasant smile, that the young countess resembled Diana in her passion for the chase as well as in her beauty, of which he had heard much. To expiate his huntsman's offence, Ilyagin pressed the Rostovs to come to an upland of his about a mile away, which he usually kept for himself and which, he said, swarmed with hares. Nikolai agreed, and the hunt, now doubled, moved on. The way to Ilyagin's upland was across the fields. The hunt servants fell into line. The masters rode together. Uncle, Rostov, and Ilyagin kept stealthily glancing at one another's dogs, trying not to be observed by their companions, and searching uneasily for rivals to their own bourgeois. Rostov was particularly struck by the beauty of a small, purebred, red-spotted bitch on Ilyagin's leash, slender, but with muscles like steel, a delicate muzzle, and prominent black eyes. He had heard of the swiftness of Ilyagin's bourgeois, and in that beautiful bitch saw a rival to his own Milka. In the middle of a sober conversation begun by Ilyagin about the year's harvest, Nikolai pointed to the red-spotted bitch. "A fine little bitch, that," said he in a careless tone. "Is she swift?" "That one? Yeah, she's a good dog. Gets what she's after," answered Ilyagin indifferently of the red-spotted bitch Erza, for which a year before he had given a neighbour 3 families of house serfs. "So, in your parts too, the harvest is nothing to boast of, Count," he went on, continuing the conversation they had begun. And considering it polite to return the young Count's compliment, Ilyagin looked at his bourgeois and picked out Milka, who attracted his attention by her breadth. "That black-spotted one of yours is fine, well-shaped," said he. "Yes, she's fast enough," replied Nikolai, and thought, "If only a full-grown hare would cross the field now, I'd show you what sort of bourgeois she is." And turning to his groom, he said he would give a ruble to anyone who found a hare. "I don't understand," continued Ilyagin, "how some sportsmen can be so jealous about game and dogs. For myself, I can tell you, Count, I enjoy riding in company such as this. What could be better?" He again raised his cap to Natasha. "But as for counting skins and what one takes, I don't care about that." "Of course not. Or being upset because someone else's bourgeois and not mine catches something. All I care about is to enjoy seeing the chase. Is it not so, Count? For I consider that..." "Ah-too!" came the long-drawn cry of one of the bourgeois whippers-in, who had halted. He stood on a knoll in the stubble, holding his whip aloft, and again repeated his long-drawn cry, "Ah-too!" This call and the uplifted whip meant that he saw a sitting hare. "Ah, he has found one, I think," said Ilyagin carelessly. "Yes, we must ride up." "Shall we both course it?" answered Nikolai, seeing in Erza and Uncle's red rugai 2 rivals he had never yet had a chance of pitting against his own bourgeois. "And suppose they outdo my Milka at once," he thought as he rode with Uncle and Ilyagin toward the hare. "A full-grown one?" asked Ilyagin as he approached the whip, who had sighted the hare, and not without agitation he looked round and whistled to Erza. "And you, Mikhail Nikanorovich," he said, addressing Uncle. The latter was riding with a sullen expression on his face. "How can I join in? Why, you've given a village for each of your bourgeois. That's it, come on. Yours are worth thousands. Try yours against one another, you two, and I'll look on." "Rugai! Hey, hey!" he shouted. "Rugaiushka!" he added, involuntarily by this diminutive expressing his affection and the hopes he placed on this red bourgeois. Natasha saw and felt the agitation the 2 elderly men and her brother were trying to conceal, and was herself excited by it. The huntsman stood halfway up the knoll, holding up his whip, and the gentlefolk rode up to him at a footpace. The hounds that were far off on the horizon turned away from the hare, and the whips, but not the gentlefolk, also moved away. All were moving slowly and sedately. "How is it pointing?" asked Nikolai, riding 100 paces toward the whip who had sighted the hare. But before the whip could reply, the hare, scenting the frost coming next morning, was unable to rest and leaped up. The pack on leash rushed downhill in full cry after the hare, and from all sides the bourgeois that were not on leash darted after the hounds and the hare. All the hunt, who had been moving slowly, shouted, "Stop!" calling in the hounds, while the bourgeois whips, with a cry of "Ah-too!" galloped across the field, setting the bourgeois on the hare.
The tranquil Ilyagin, Nikolai, Natasha, and uncle flew, reckless of where and how they went, seeing only the Borzois and the hare, and fearing only to lose sight even for an instant of the chase. The hare they had started was a strong and swift one. When he jumped up, he did not run at once, but pricked his ears, listening to the shouting and trampling that resounded from all sides at once. He took a dozen bounds, not very quickly, letting the Borzois gain on him, and finally, having chosen his direction and realizing his danger, laid back his ears and rushed off headlong. He had been lying in the stubble, but in front of him was the autumn sowing where the ground was soft. The two Borzois of the huntsman who had sighted him, having been the nearest, were the first to see and pursue him. But they had not gone far before Ilyagin's red-spotted Urzar passed them, got within a length, flew at the hare with terrible swiftness, aiming at his scut, and thinking she had seized him, rolled over like a ball. The hare arched his back and bounded off yet more swiftly. From behind Urzar rushed the broad-haunched black-spotted Milka and began rapidly gaining on the hare.
"Milashka, dear!" rose Nikolai's triumphant cry. It looked as if Milka would immediately pounce on the hare, but she overtook him and flew past. The hare had squatted. Again the beautiful Urzar reached him, but when close to the hare's scut, paused as if measuring the distance, so as not to make a mistake this time, but seize his hind leg. "Urzar, darling!" Ilyagin wailed in a voice unlike his own. Urzar did not hearken to his appeal. At the very moment when she would have seized her prey, the hare moved and darted along the balk between the winter rye and the stubble. Again Urzar and Milka were abreast, running like a pair of carriage horses, and began to overtake the hare. But it was easier for the hare to run on the balk, and the Borzois did not overtake him so quickly.
"Rugai, Rugaiushka, that's it, come on!" came a third voice just then, and Uncle's red Borzois, straining and curving its back, caught up with the two foremost Borzois, pushed ahead of them regardless of the terrible strain, put on speed close to the hare, knocked it off the bulk onto the rye field, again put on speed still more viciously, sinking to his knees in the muddy field, and all one could see was how, muddying his back, he rolled over with the hare. A ring of Borzois surrounded him. A moment later, everyone had drawn up round the crowd of dogs. Only the delighted uncle dismounted and cut off a pad, shaking the hare for the blood to drip off, and anxiously glancing round with restless eyes while his arms and legs twitched. He spoke without himself knowing whom to or what about. "That's it! Come on! That's a dog! There it has beaten them all! The 1,000-ruble as well as the 1-ruble Borzois! That's it! Come on!" said he, panting and looking wrathfully around, as if he were abusing someone, as if they were all his enemies and had insulted him, and only now had he at last succeeded in justifying himself. "There are your 1,000-ruble ones, that's it, come on. Rugai, here's a pad for you," he said, throwing down the hare's muddy pad. "You've deserved it, that's it, come on."
"She'd tired herself out, she'd run it down 3 times by herself," said Nikolai, also not listening to anyone and regardless of whether he were heard or not.
"But what is there in running across it like that?" said Ilyagin's groom.
"Once she had missed it and turned it away, any mongrel could take it," Ilyagin was saying at the same time, breathless from his gallop and his excitement. At the same moment, Natasha, without drawing breath, screamed joyously, ecstatically, and so piercingly that it set everyone's ears tingling. By that shriek, she expressed what the others expressed by all talking at once, and it was so strange that she must herself have been ashamed of so wild a cry, and everyone else would have been amazed at it at any other time. Uncle himself twisted up the hare, threw it neatly and smartly across the horse's back, as if by that gesture he meant to rebuke everybody, and with an air of not wishing to speak to anyone, mounted his bay and rode off. The others all followed, dispirited and shamefaced, and only much later were they able to regain their former affectation of indifference. For a long time they continued to look at Red Rugai, who, his arched back spattered with mud and clanking the ring of his leash, walked along just behind Uncle's horse with the serene air of a conqueror. "Well, I am like any other dog, as long as it's not a question of coursing, but when it is, then look out," his appearance seemed to Nikolai to be saying. When, much later,
Uncle rode up to Nikolai and began talking to him. He felt flattered that, after what had happened, Uncle deigned to speak to him. Chapter 7. An Evening at Uncle's. Toward evening, Ilyagin took leave of Nikolai, who found that they were so far from home that he accepted Uncle's offer that the hunting party should spend the night in his little village of Mikhailovna.
"And if you put up at my house, that'll be better still. That's it. Come on," said Uncle. "You see, it's damp weather, and you could rest, and the little countess could be driven home in a trap."
Uncle's offer was accepted. A huntsman was sent to Otradnoye for a trap, while Nikolai rode with Natasha and Petya to Uncle's house. Some 5 male domestic serfs, big and little, rushed out to the front porch to meet their master. A score of women serfs, old and young, as well as children, popped out from the back entrance to have a look at the hunters who were arriving. The presence of Natasha, a woman, a lady, and on horseback, raised the curiosity of the serfs to such a degree that many of them came up to her, stared her in the face, and, unabashed by her presence, made remarks about her as though she were some prodigy on show and not a human being able to hear or understand what was said about her.
"Arinka, look, she sits sideways. There she sits, and her skirt dangles. See, she's got a little hunting horn. Goodness gracious, see her knife? Isn't she a Tartar?" "How is it you didn't go head over heels?" asked the boldest of all, addressing Natasha directly.
Uncle dismounted at the porch of his little wooden house, which stood in the midst of an overgrown garden, and after a glance at his retainers, shouted authoritatively that the superfluous ones should take themselves off, and that all necessary preparations should be made to receive the guests and the visitors. The serfs all dispersed. Uncle lifted Natasha off her horse, and taking her hand, led her up the rickety wooden steps of the porch. The house, with its bare, unplastered log walls, was not over clean. It did not seem that those living in it aimed at keeping it spotless, but neither was it noticeably neglected. In the entry there was a smell of fresh apples, and wolf and fox skins hung about. Uncle led the visitors through the anteroom into a small hall with a folding table and red chairs, then into the drawing-room with a round birchwood table and a sofa, and finally into his private room, where there was a tattered sofa, a worn carpet, and portraits of Suvorov, of the host's father and mother, and of himself in military uniform. The study smelt strongly of tobacco and dogs. Uncle asked his visitors to sit down and make themselves at home, and then went out of the room. Rugai, his back still muddy, came into the room and lay down on the sofa, cleaning himself with his tongue and teeth. Leading from the study was a passage in which a partition with ragged curtains could be seen. From behind this came women's laughter and whispers. Natasha, Nikolai, and Petya took off their wraps and sat down on the sofa. Petya, leaning on his elbow, fell asleep at once. Natasha and Nikolai were silent. Their faces glowed, they were hungry and very cheerful. They looked at one another. Now that the hunt was over and they were in the house, Nikolai no longer considered it necessary to show his manly superiority over his sister. Natasha gave him a wink, and neither refrained long from bursting into a peal of ringing laughter even before they had a pretext ready to account for it. After a while, Uncle came in a Cossack coat, blue trousers, and small top boots, and Natasha felt that this costume, the very one she had regarded with surprise and amusement at Otradnoye, was just the right thing, and not at all worse than a swallowtail or frock coat. Uncle, too, was in high spirits, and far from being offended by the brothers and sisters' laughter, it could never enter his head that they might be laughing at his way of life, he himself joined in the merriment.
"That's right, young countess, that's it, come on. I never saw anyone like her," said he, offering Nikolai a pipe with a long stem,
and with a practised motion of 3 fingers taking down another that had been cut short.
"She's ridden all day like a man, and is as fresh as ever."
Soon after Uncle's reappearance, the door was opened, evidently from the sound by a barefooted girl, and a stout, rosy, good-looking woman of about 40, with a double chin and full red lips, entered carrying a large loaded tray. With hospitable dignity and cordiality in her glance and in every motion, she looked at the visitors and, with a pleasant smile, bowed respectfully. In spite of her exceptional stoutness, which caused her to protrude her chest and stomach and throw back her head, this woman, who was Uncle's housekeeper, trod very lightly. She went to the table, set down the tray, and with her plump white hands deftly took from it the bottles and various hors d'oeuvres and dishes and arranged them on the table. When she had finished, she stepped aside and stopped at the door with a smile on her face. "Here I am. I am she. Now do you understand, Uncle?" her expression said to Rostov. How could one help understanding? Not only Nikolai, but even Natasha understood the meaning of his puckered brow and the happy, complacent smile that slightly puckered his lips when Anisya Fyodorovna entered. On the tray was a bottle of herb wine, different kinds of vodka, pickled mushrooms, rye cakes made with buttermilk, honey in the comb, still mead and sparkling mead, apples, nuts, raw and roasted, and nut and honey sweets. Afterwards she brought a freshly roasted chicken, ham, preserves made with honey, and preserves made with sugar. All this was the fruit of Anisya Fyodorovna's housekeeping, gathered and prepared by her. The smell and taste of it all had a smack of Anisya Fyodorovna herself, a savour of juiciness, cleanliness, whiteness, and pleasant smiles. "Take this, little lady countess," she kept saying as she offered Natasha first one thing and then another. Natasha ate of everything and thought she had never seen or eaten such buttermilk cakes, such aromatic jam, such honey and nut sweets, or such a chicken anywhere. Anisya Fyodorovna left the room. After supper, over their cherry brandy, Rostov and Uncle talked of past and future hunts, of Rugai and Ilyagin's dogs, while Natasha sat upright on the sofa and listened with sparkling eyes. She tried several times to wake Petya that he might eat something, but he only muttered incoherent words without waking up. Natasha felt so light-hearted and happy in these novel surroundings that she only feared the trap would come for her too soon. After a casual pause, such as often occurs when receiving friends for the first time in one's house, Uncle, answering a thought that was in his visitor's mind, said,
"This, you see, is how I'm finishing my days. Death will come. That's it. Come on. Nothing will remain. Then why harm anyone?"
Uncle's face was very significant and even handsome as he said this. Involuntarily, Rostov recalled all the good he had heard about him from his father and the neighbours. Throughout the whole province, Uncle had the reputation of being the most honourable and disinterested of cranks. They called him in to decide family disputes, chose him as executor, confided secrets to him, elected him to be a justice and to other posts, but he always persistently refused public appointments, passing the autumn and spring in the fields on his bay gelding, sitting at home in winter, and lying in his overgrown garden in summer. "Why don't you enter the service, Uncle?"
"I did once, but gave it up. I'm not fit for it. That's it. Come on. I can't make head or tail of it. That's for you. I haven't brains enough. Now, hunting is another matter. That's it. Come on.
Open the door there," he shouted. "Why have you shut it?"
The door at the end of the passage led to the huntsmen's rooms, as they called the room for the hunt servants. There was a rapid patter of bare feet, and an unseen hand opened the door into the huntsmen's rooms, from which came the clear sounds of a balalaika on which someone, who was evidently a master of the art, was playing. Natasha had been listening to those strains for some time now, and went out into the passage to hear better.
"That's Mitka, my coachman. I've got him a good balalaika. I'm fond of it," said Uncle.
It was the custom for Mitka to play the balalaika in the huntsman's rooms when Uncle returned from the chase. Uncle was fond of such music.
"How good! Really, very good," said Nikolai with some unintentional superciliousness, as if ashamed to confess that the sounds pleased him very much.
"Very good," said Natasha reproachfully, noticing her brother's tone. "Not very good. It's simply delicious."
Just as Uncle's pickled mushrooms, honey, and sherry brandy had seemed to her the best in the world, so also that song at that moment seemed to her the acme of musical delight.
"More, please, more!"
cried Natasha at the door as soon as the balalaika ceased. Mitka tuned up afresh and recommenced thrumming the balalaika to the air of My Lady with trills and variations. Uncle sat listening, slightly smiling, with his head on one side. The air was repeated 100 times. The balalaika was retuned several times, and the same notes were thrummed again, but the listeners did not grow weary of it and wished to hear it again and again. Anisya Fyodorovna came in and leaned her portly person against the doorpost.
"You like listening?"
she said to Natasha with a smile extremely like Uncle's.
"That's a good player of ours," she added. "He doesn't play that part right," said Uncle suddenly, with an energetic gesture. "Here he ought to burst out. That's it, come on, ought to burst out."
"Do you play then?" asked Natasha.
Uncle did not answer but smiled.
"Anisya, go and see if the strings of my guitar are all right. I haven't touched it for a long time. That's it, come on. I've given it up."
Anisya Fyodorovna, with her light step, willingly went to fulfil her errand and brought back the guitar. Without looking at anyone, Uncle blew the dust off it and, tapping the case with his bony fingers, tuned the guitar and settled himself in his armchair. He took the guitar a little above the fingerboard, arching his left elbow with a somewhat theatrical gesture, and with a wink at Anisya Fyodorovna, struck a single chord, pure and sonorous, and then, quietly, smoothly, and confidently, began playing in very slow time, not My Lady, but the well-known song Came a Maiden Down the Street. The tune, played with precision and in exact time, began to thrill in the hearts of Nikolai and Natasha, arousing in them the same kind of sober mirth as radiated from Anisya Fyodorovna's whole being. Anisya Fyodorovna flushed, and drawing her kerchief over her face, went laughing out of the room. Uncle continued to play correctly, carefully, with energetic firmness, looking with a changed and inspired expression at the spot where Anisya Fyodorovna had just stood. Something seemed to be laughing a little on one side of his face under his grey moustaches, especially as the song grew brisker and the time quicker, and when, here and there, as he ran his fingers over the strings, something seemed to snap.
"Lovely, lovely! Go on, Uncle, go on!" shouted Natasha as soon as he had finished. She jumped up and hugged and kissed him. "Nikolai, Nikolai!" she said, turning to her brother as if asking him, "What is it that moves me so?"
Nikolai, too, was greatly pleased by Uncle's playing, and Uncle played the piece over again. Anisya Fyodorovna's smiling face reappeared in the doorway, and behind hers other faces. "Fetching water clear and sweet, stop, dear maiden, I entreat," played Uncle once more, running his fingers skilfully over the strings, and then he stopped short and jerked his shoulders.
"Go on, Uncle dear,"
Natasha wailed in an imploring tone, as if her life depended on it. Uncle rose, and it was as if there were two men in him. One of them smiled seriously at the merry fellow, while the merry fellow struck a naive and precise attitude preparatory to a folk dance.
"Now then, niece!" he exclaimed, waving to Natasha the hand that had just struck a chord.
Natasha threw off the shawl from her shoulders, ran forward to face Uncle, and setting her arms akimbo, also made a motion with her shoulders and struck an attitude. Where, how, and when had this young countess, educated by an émigré French governess, imbibed from the Russian air she breathed that spirit and obtained that manner which the pas de Charles would, one would have supposed, long ago have effaced? But the spirit and the movements were those inimitable and unteachable Russian ones that Uncle had expected of her. As soon as she had struck her pose and smiled triumphantly, proudly, and with sly merriment, The fear that had at first seized Nikolai and the others that she might not do the right thing was at an end, and they were already admiring her. She did the right thing with such precision, such complete precision, that Anisya Fyodorovna, who had at once handed her the handkerchief she needed for the dance, had tears in her eyes, though she laughed as she watched this slim, graceful countess, reared in silks and velvets and so different from herself, who was yet able to understand all that was in Anisya and in Anisya's father and mother and aunt and in every Russian man and woman.
"Well, little countess, that's it. Come on!" cried uncle with a joyous laugh, having finished the dance. "Well done, niece! Now a fine young fellow must be found as husband for you. That's it. Come on!"
"He's chosen already," said Nikolai, smiling.
"Oh?"
said uncle in surprise, looking inquiringly at Natasha, who nodded her head with a happy smile.
"And such a one!" she said. But as soon as she had said it, a new train of thoughts and feelings arose in her. What did Nikolai's smile mean when he said, "chosen already"? Is he glad of it or not? It is as if he thought my Bolkonski would not approve of or understand our gaiety, but he would understand it all. Where is he now? She thought, and her face suddenly became serious.
But this lasted only a second.
Don't dare to think about it, she said to herself, and sat down again smilingly beside uncle, begging him to play something more.
Uncle played another song and a valse. Then, after a pause, he cleared his throat and sang his favourite hunting song.
"As 'twas growing dark last night, fell the snow so soft and light."
Uncle sang as peasants sing, with full and naive conviction that the whole meaning of a song lies in the words, and that the tune comes of itself, and that apart from the words there is no tune, which exists only to give measure to the words. As a result of this, the unconsidered tune, like the song of a bird, was extraordinarily good. Natasha was in ecstasies over uncle's singing. She resolved to give up learning the harp and to play only the guitar. She asked uncle for his guitar and at once found the chords of the song. After 9 o'clock, 2 traps and 3 mounted men who had been sent to look for them arrived to fetch Natasha and Petya. "The Count and Countess did not know where they were and were very anxious," said one of the men. Petya was carried out like a log and laid in the larger of the 2 traps. Natasha and Nikolai got into the other. Uncle wrapped Natasha up warmly and took leave of her with quite a new tenderness. He accompanied them on foot as far as the bridge that could not be crossed, so they had to go round by the ford, and he sent huntsmen to ride in front with lanterns.
"Goodbye, dear niece,"
his voice called out of the darkness. Not the voice Natasha had known previously, but the one that had sung, "As 'twas growing dark last night." In the village through which they passed, there were red lights and a cheerful smell of smoke.
"What a darling uncle is," said Natasha when they had come out onto the high road.
"Yes," returned Nikolai. "You're not cold?"
"No, I'm quite all right. I feel so comfortable," answered Natasha, almost perplexed by her feelings.
They remained silent a long while. The night was dark and damp. They could not see the horses, but only heard them splashing through the unseen mud. What was passing in that receptive, childlike soul that so eagerly caught and assimilated all the diverse impressions of life? How did they all find place in her? But she was very happy. As they were nearing home, she suddenly struck up the air of "As 'twas growing dark last night," the tune of which she had all the way been trying to get and had at last caught.
"Got it?" said Nikolai. "What were you thinking about just now, Nikolai?" inquired Natasha.
They were fond of asking one another that question.
"I?" said Nikolai, trying to remember.
"Well, you see, first I thought that Rugai, the red hound, was like uncle, and that if he were a man, he would always keep uncle near him, if not for his riding, then for his manner. What a good fellow uncle is. Don't you think so?"
"Well, and you?" "I? Wait a bit, wait. Yes, first I thought that we are driving along and imagining that we are going home, but that heaven knows where we are really going in the darkness, and that we shall arrive and suddenly find that we are not in Otradnoia, but in Fairyland. And then I thought, no, nothing else.
I know. I expect you thought of him, said Nikolai, smiling, as Natasha knew by the sound of his voice.
No, said Natasha, though she had in reality been thinking about Prince Andrei at the same time as of the rest, and of how he would have liked Uncle. And then I was saying to myself all the way, how well Anisia carried herself, how well! And Nikolai heard her spontaneous, happy, ringing laughter. And you know, she suddenly said, I know that I shall never again be as happy and tranquil as I am now.
Rubbish, nonsense, humbug, exclaimed Nikolai, and he thought, how charming this Natasha of mine is. I have no other friend like her, never shall have. Why should she marry? We might always drive about together.
What a darling this Nikolai of mine is, thought Natasha. Ah, there are still lights in the drawing-room, she said, pointing to the windows of the house that gleamed invitingly in the moist, velvety darkness of the night.
Chapter 8 Nikolai's Mother Finds Him a Bride. Count Ilya Rostov had resigned the position of Marshal of the Nobility because it involved him in too much expense, but still his affairs did not improve. Natasha and Nikolai often noticed their parents conferring together anxiously and privately, and heard suggestions of selling the fine ancestral Rostov house and estate near Moscow. It was not necessary to entertain so freely as when the Count had been Marshal, and life at Otradnoye was quieter than in former years, but still the enormous house and its lodges were full of people, and more than 20 sat down to table every day. These were all their own people who had settled down in the house almost as members of the family, or persons who were, it seemed, obliged to live in the Count's house. Such were Dimler, the musician, and his wife, Fogel, the dancing master, and his family, Belova, an old maiden lady who lived in the house, and many others such as Petya's tutors, the girl's former governess, and other people who simply found it preferable and more advantageous to live in the Count's house than at home. They had not as many visitors as before, but the old habits of life without which the Count and Countess could not conceive of existence remained unchanged. There was still the hunting establishment which Nikolai had even enlarged, the same 50 horses and 15 grooms in the stables, the same expensive presents and dinner parties to the whole district on name days. There were still the Count's games of whist and Boston, at which, spreading out his cards so that everybody could see them, he let himself be plundered of hundreds of roubles every day by his neighbours, who looked upon an opportunity to play a rubber with Count Rostov as a most profitable source of income. The Count moved in his affairs as in a huge net, trying not to believe that he was entangled, but becoming more and more so at every step, and feeling too feeble to break the meshes or set to work carefully and patiently to disentangle them. The Countess, with her loving heart, felt that her children were being ruined, that it was not the Count's fault, for he could not help being what he was, that, though he tried to hide it, he himself suffered from the consciousness of his own and his children's ruin, and she tried to find means of remedying the position. From her feminine point of view, she could only see one solution, namely, for Nikolai to marry a rich heiress. She felt this to be their last hope, and that if Nikolai refused the match she had found for him, she would have to abandon the hope of ever getting matters right. This match was with Julie Karagina, the daughter of excellent and virtuous parents, a girl the Rostovs had known from childhood, and who had now become a wealthy heiress through the death of the last of her brothers. The Countess had written direct to Julie's mother in Moscow, suggesting a marriage between their children, and had received a favourable answer from her. Karagina had replied that for her part she was agreeable, and everything depended on her daughter's inclination. She invited Nikolai to come to Moscow. Several times the Countess, with tears in her eyes, told her son that now both her daughters were settled, her only wish was to see him married. She said she could lie down in her grave peacefully if that were accomplished. Then she told him that she knew of a splendid girl, and tried to discover what he thought about marriage. At other times she praised Julie to him and advised him to go to Moscow during the holidays to amuse himself. Nikolai guessed what his mother's remarks were leading to, and during one of these conversations induced her to speak quite frankly. She told him,